Good morning and welcome to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, July 28th. I'm your reader, Cynthia Pokorna Martinez, and we will start with the first article entitled CBCSD Raises Subpay. Board approves pay increase for substitute teachers, holds hearing on Kingsville Project. This is an article by Tim Johnson. The Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education approved a pay increase for substitute teachers Tuesday to ensure that the school district remains competitive with other metro area districts. The board raised the daily pay rate for occasional substitutes from $165 to $170, and the rate for long-term substitutes from $175 to $180. We're trying to stay near the top of our market, said Gary Milbourne, Chief of Human Resources. Last year we raised it $10 per day, and this year we raised it $5. It definitely keeps us near the top in our area. Our goal is to cover the classrooms and keep that continuity of instruction going. The district has used teachers on call to schedule substitutes for the past 2 years, and the board voted at its May 24th meeting to contribute to do so this year. Besides lining up substitute teachers and paraeducators, teachers on call trains the substitutes, completes yearly background checks, manages licensure, and covers workers' compensation and liability for the subs. The substitutes become employees of teachers on call and are paid by them, and the district reimburses the service each substitute's daily rate plus an administrative markup. This article continues on the next page and says, Milbourne said he appreciates having the teachers on call team to focus specifically on substitutes. The board also held a public hearing on a proposed renovation of the former Washington Elementary School, where the Kanesville Alternative Learning Center is currently housed. Kanesville students will attend classes at the 9th Avenue School building that has been used for the Heartland Family Service Therapeutic School in recent years to clear the way for work at their building. Therapeutic school students will attend the organization's Omaha program this school year. And there's a great photo of livestock on share at West Fair. And there are there's a young man and a young woman cleaning up their steers. And this says, siblings Reese, 13, and Isabel Vortman, she's 11, with the Silver Keg Feeders 4-H Club, wash down their heifers, at West Fair continues on Wednesday, July 27th. The action continues Thursday at the West Fair Fairgrounds and Amphitheater with several 4-H shows and other activities going on. The Dairy and Goat Show runs at 7:30 a.m. The Sheep Show is at 10 a.m. and the Poultry Show is at 3 p.m. The working exhibits will be shown at 5:30 and the Educational Presentation Awards will be at 6:30. The Carnival Rides will be starting up as well, and Cycle Circus Live will energize the green space for multiple shows throughout the day. And there are some photos beneath this main photo with the heifers. And there's a photo of a young boy holding a goat, and it says, Hunter Johnson, a member of the Crossroads Ag 4-H Club, holds a baby goat. It's a little black one with little tannish ears. It's really cute. And then Bella La Scala and Casey Lang with the Silver Keg Feeders 4-H Club shear a crossbred sheep. And Madeline Williams with the Crossroads Ag 4-H Club 12 shows off one of her baby Nigerian goats. And oh, it's so cute. It's a very kind of a caramel brown color with a little black on its face. Just a little cutie. Yes, I grew up on a farm and we did have baby goats. So this one is Reynolds's justice pick is May. David May, a state appeals court judge from Polk City, is the newest Iowa Supreme Court justice, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday, as she announced her fifth appointment to the seven-member court. May replaces former Justice Brent Appel, who retired this year upon reaching the state-mandated state Supreme Court retirement age of 72. Appel was the court's last remaining member appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. The other two members were appointed by then-Governor Terry Branstad, a Republican. May, 51, was a finalist for an Iowa Supreme Court vacancy in 2020. For the current vacancy, he was chosen from among three finalists. At every point in this decision, Judge May at the Iowa Court of Appeals stood out for his experience, his approach to interpretation, and his commitment to judicial restraint, Reynolds said during a news conference. A graduate of Drake University Law School, May has been serving on the Iowa Court of Appeals since 2019. Previously, he was a district judge in Central Iowa's 5th Judicial District. May said he is excited to begin his work on the Supreme Court. And he says, I know the work will involve new challenges, certainly a different kind of case mix. But whether you're at the district court or the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, the basic principles of judging remain the same. Judges don't exercise the powers of the executive and the legislature. We have a different job. Our job is to decide legal disputes. We call them cases. And we decide those cases based on the law as it is written and consistent with our oath to support the Constitution of the United States and support the Constitution of the state of Iowa. Five judges applied for the most recent Supreme Court vacancy. The state's Judicial Nominating Committee whittled that field down to three finalists, from which Reynolds made her appointment. Justices are paid over $180,000 a year. The other finalists were Alan Heavens, a Northeast Iowa District Court judge from Garnavillo, and William Miller, a lawyer with Dorsey and Whitney in Des Moines. This article goes on to say, while introducing her latest Supreme Court appointment, Reynolds on multiple occasions praised May's judicial philosophy. He understands that in our system of government, laws are made only by those who are directly accountable to the people, and that as a result, judges should respect the democratic process whenever possible, Reynolds says. Reynolds recently asked the Iowa Supreme Court to overturn a 2018 ruling that created a state right for women to have access to abortion services. With a different makeup than the one that made that 2018 ruling, the state Supreme Court overturned the 2018 ruling, which put into effect a 24-hour waiting period before a pregnant woman can have an abortion. Combined with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling a week later that eliminated the federal right to an abortion, the rulings cleared the way for more strict abortion restrictions in Iowa. Currently, abortion is legal in Iowa until 20 weeks of pregnancy. Reynolds also asked the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear the case in order to determine what kind of legal scrutiny the court will apply to future abortion restrictions. The court declined that request, sending the question first to a district court judge, but one that likely is to return eventually to the Supreme Court. Reynolds is running for re-election to another four-year term. The Democratic challenger in this fall's election, Deidre DeGeer, issued a statement Wednesday asserting that Reynolds' appointment of May was politically motivated. She says, Iowans deserve leadership that puts them first. This appointment to the Supreme Court of Iowa is another effort of Kim Reynolds, in line with the Republican Party agenda, to pack the courts with justices who do not represent the whole of our great state, DeGeer said in a statement. This trajectory is a great danger to our everyday freedoms. The rule of law should be considered with impartiality, not twisted for political gain. May's appointment to the Supreme Court creates a vacancy on the Court of Appeals that Reynolds will now move to fill. The Supreme Court's next oral arguments are scheduled for mid-September, according to the court's calendar. Teva agrees to $4.25 billion settlement. Agreement would provide cash, naloxone, to address opioid crisis to Iowa, other states. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller announced that drug maker Teva, T-E-V-A, has agreed to contribute more than $4.2 billion in cash and medications to settle lawsuits in various states, including Iowa, that claimed the company contributed to the U.S. opioid epidemic. Details of the settlement announced Tuesday remain subject of ongoing negotiations, according to Miller's office. The agreement is preliminary, and work continues to determine how much each state will receive and what those funds will be used for, a spokesperson said. In the past, funds stemming from agreements with opioid manufacturers have been used to abate and help Iowans recover from addiction through prevention and treatment. Miller's office last year signed an agreement with University of Iowa Healthcare to develop a comprehensive statewide opioid treatment program using $3.8 million in settlement funds. Teva disclosed the preliminary settlement agreement Tuesday ahead of its earnings announcement Wednesday. This is another major step in addressing the opioids crisis, Miller said in a statement. Iowa was among 12 states that negotiated the settlement framework. The deal in principle would rank among the larger ones so far in a years-long trend of companies settling the complicated lawsuits over the toll from an addiction and overdose epidemic, which has been linked to more than 500,000 deaths in the U.S. over the last two decades, the Associated Press reported. In their lawsuits, state governments and others claimed the Israel-based company promoted Actic, and Fentora, prescription opioids approved to treat cancer pain, plus generic opioids, including oxycodone, for use by non-cancer patients. The states also said the company downplayed the addiction risks and overstated their benefits, including encouraging the idea that signs of addiction were actually pseudo-addiction treated by prescribing more opioids. States also claimed the company and its distributor, Onda, failed to comply with requirements on monitoring and reporting suspicious orders. Teva would pay $4.25 billion over 13 years to participating states and local governments, with most of the money going to fight the opioid epidemic. The settlement includes providing up to $1.2 billion worth of naloxone, a drug that reverses overdoses at no charge over 10 years. States could opt to take $240 million cash instead if they choose. The preliminary agreement also includes payouts from several settlements the company has recently reached with individual states. We expect these funds to make a significant difference in preventing fatal overdoses and treating opioid addiction disorder, Miller said. And there is one more article on the front page, and there are some photos adjacent to it. The photos in the article are by David Goldbitz, or it's Goldbitz maybe. The first one is State Auditor Rob Sand met with residents at Sunset Park on July 21st as part of his 100 town hall tour. And then State Auditor Rob Sand wants the Office of the Auditor to do more than investigate whether taxpayer money was misappropriated. He wants the office to be more proactive in saving taxpayers' money, too. And the article is Sand Talks Saving Taxpayer Money. Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand was once told by a colleague that he had, quote, never seen more middle managers and bureaucrats worried about what the state auditor's office is going to say, end quote, which is a compliment as far as Sand is concerned. Sand says they should be worried. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. If it feels like I'm suing you, like, well, don't do the thing that you might get sued for. Let me repeat that. if it feels like I'm suing you, like, well, don't do the thing that you might get sued for. Okay. The auditor's office works as nonpartisan watchdog for Iowans by providing audit, review, and other technical services to state and local governments to investigate whether taxpayer dollars are being used properly and to issue reports detailing any improper conduct. And he's quoted, if we can keep people from messing something up and doing something they shouldn't do before they do it, that's way better than catching them after the fact, Sand said during a July 21st meeting with residents at Sunset Park. Sand tries not to concern himself too much with what the government does after the auditor's office issues its reports. At that point, it's out of my hands. And Sand says, if my job is to tell you if your toe's over the line and I holler at you because your toe's on the line, you might say, oh, it's not over the line, or it's an accident, it's a mistake. My job's to say what happened. If everybody decides they don't care, they can decide that. But I'm going to do my job. Sand was in Council Bluffs as part of his 100 Town Hall tour, an annual trip around the state that allows him to highlight the accomplishments of the office, speak with residents face-to-face, and listen to their concerns. Sand also used the opportunity to talk about an aspect of the auditor's role that historically hasn't been utilized, to promote government efficiency and find ways to save taxpayer money. Sand and his team came up with a program that would do just that, and they called it PIE, PIE, which stands for Public Innovations and Efficiencies. He says, once we designed the program and we had an idea of what we were looking at, we loved what we had put together. We were proud of it. We were like, this is going to be great. We're going to save a ton of money for people. It's going to be fun to participate in. It's going to be as popular as PIE. After the team had decided that PIE was the acronym they wanted to use, they then had to come up with three words that would fit the three letters, hence public innovations and efficiencies. We have what we call the PIE chart, a 4-to-5-page checklist of basic money-saving practices, Sand said. You can do them in your home or your city or your county can do it to save money. Cities, counties, and school districts are asked to fill out the checklist, marking yes for practices they do and no for ones they don't. Then they send the checklist to the auditor's office where the public can see what their city or county or school district is or isn't doing to save money. Entities that send in the PIE chart are also entered into what Sand called the PIE contest, where counties, cities, and school districts are divided into groups based on size, and the entity that has the best score receives a visit from Sand, who brings certificates acknowledging the good work being done. When visiting, Sand also brings PIE. Those are very exciting days, Sand said. I get a sugar rush that lasts all day because I keep re-upping every hour with another slice of PIE. Aside from all the PIE, Sand also enjoys the opportunity to provide some positive feedback to public officials and municipal employees. Sand says, our office is always kind of poking at public officials. That's part of our job, but this is a nice way to partner with people and actually say, hey, look, you got some public officials here that are doing a good job. People who work for the city work for the county, typically. They're putting in a lot of hours. They're working hard. They're solving real problems, and they don't get a lot of recognition for it, Sand said. So when we can come around and we can say, hey, look, your city here is doing a really good job to save it money, that's good. We should call the bad, bad, but also call the good, good. It's nice to have that balance. Another aspect of the PIE program is something Sand called PIE recipes, which allows the auditor's office to share money-saving ideas across the entire state. If you come up with something in Pot County that saves money, tell us what it is, Sand said. What we do is we take the idea, we add it to the PIE chart, and then everybody who participates in the program That chart gets circulated to them every year, so it makes it easy for more people to copy the idea and put it into place. The pie chart also includes contact information for the person who came up with each idea, so if anyone has questions about how to implement a program, they can go straight to the source. In the second year of the PIE program, the number of public entities participating went from 330 to more than 500, said Sand. We're seeing more governmental entities participating, and we're seeing them actually get more efficiency practice into place as they're participating. Sand also touted a federal program that helps school districts pay to replace buses to lighten the burden on Iowa taxpayers. The federal government, through the bipartisan infrastructure bill that President Biden signed in 2021, will replace up to 25 buses per school district with zero or low emission buses. Sand also lamented the lack of cooperation he sees between Iowa's political parties. Sand, a Democrat from Decorah, said that the Republican-controlled state government doesn't want to do something that makes it look like a Democrat ever had a good idea. As an example, Sand said that he would like to see mandatory prison sentences for people who steal, quote, a large amount, unquote, of public money. He cited a former Mills County Treasury employee who in 2004 was given a 25-year suspended sentence and probation and was ordered to pay restitution after being found guilty of stealing public funds. In 2013, another former Mills County Treasury employee was found guilty of stealing $36,000 from the county. Citing the importance of deterrence, the judge in that case sentenced the employee to the maximum 25 years in prison, a penalty that Sand would probably say was too harsh. You don't need to lock them up and throw away the key, Sand said. It's no more probation. It doesn't need to be a long sentence. Everybody I talked to about this has said the reason that they don't pass it isn't because they disagree. In Sand's view, if you want to be a public servant, if you want to be involved in governance, you should be interested in every good idea. And that isn't just a soundbite. Sand really means it. You want to have decision-making done by people who think a little differently than yourself, Sand said. If you all think the same way about everything, you end up doing groupthink, and you end up not considering this aspect or that aspect of the problem. To hold himself accountable and to ensure partisan politics don't get in the way of the work, Sand hired and promoted Republicans and independents to senior positions within the office, even people who contributed to his opponent's campaign in 2018. Sand says, "I want everyone in the state to know that we are working to represent everybody. We are working to make sure this office is focused on truth and integrity and accountability. And those are things that shouldn't have a political persuasion to them." All right, folks, we are ready for behind page one and my favorite article, Face of the Day. And there is a photo of a woman named Callie Earlywine. Is no stranger to the fight against cancer, nor is she a stranger to Spirit of Courage. She says, "I was honored as a Spirit of Courage recipient in 2010. It was such a wonderful night to experience with my family, friends, and the SOC family, Spirit of Courage. It is truly a celebration of a person's battle with cancer. Whether you win or lose this battle, the honor is so special." Callie is no stranger to the world of volunteering either. She has volunteered for many organizations, schools, and her church over the course of the years. Creating t-shirt quilts is her passion. "I have made many for so many different situations, birthdays, graduations, retirements, to celebrate a special profession, and my favorite, to honor a loved one lost." Callie and family have attended Spirit of Courage events each year since her diagnosis to help keep what she refers to as, quote, "a wonderful charity," quote, going forever. This year, Callie was asked to volunteer for the Spirit of Courage Gala Dinner event. She and her sister, Christy Nicholson, have been working to contact all past recipients of this year's 20th anniversary. "We were thrilled to be able to do this and give back for all we get in return by being part of Spirit of Courage," Callie said. I have enjoyed talking to so many people that love Spirit of Courage as much as I do. Every year when you walk into the gala lobby, the posters greet you showing the recipients of all past years of the SOC award. I have my picture taken here every year by my poster to celebrate how lucky I am to be here celebrating at Spirit of Courage with my family and new and former recipients. Spirit of Courage is about honoring friends and family for their courage, while at the same time raising money to help cancer patients with anything they may need during their battle. This is an exceptional charity to be a part of, and our family enjoys the support we get and give every year. Callie and her husband, Rod, have been married 49 years. Together, they have two daughters. Daughter Jennifer Gibbons and her husband, Derek, live in Lincoln and have three daughters, Ella, Hope, and Abby. Their other daughter, Alyssa Morasser, and her husband, Nathan, live in Denton and have what Callie calls, quote, our three grand dogs, Lola, Maisie, and Duke. She and Rod retired in 2020 and moved to Lincoln to be closer to their children and grandchildren. The 2022 Spirit of Courage Gala will be held August 6, 2021 for 2022 recipients. Donna Eliff, Deb Potter, Jake Powers, and Kevin Rutland will be honored, as well as all past recipients. The gala begins at 6 p.m. with cocktails and the opening of the silent auction. Dinner begins at 7 p.m., followed by the live auction and awards. This year's gala will be held at the Mid-America Center, One Arena Way, Council Bluffs. Individual tickets are $80 with table sponsorship, which is 10 seats, priced at $800. You are listening to the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, July 28th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And we're going to turn to today's obituaries, and there are several of them. The first one is Orville Deland McGee, and Orville was 88, of Council Bluffs, passed away July 25th. He was born on November 11th in 1933 in Omaha, Nebraska, to L. Deland and Dorothy McDaniels McGee. Along with his parents, he was preceded in death by his brother James McGee of Council Bluffs. Orville attended high school at Abraham Lincoln in Council Bluffs. After graduating in 1952, Orville enlisted in the Army, where he took the opportunity to qualify as an elite member of a select branch in the Special Forces Airborne Unit known as the Green Berets. While in Special Forces training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Orville was attending a class on March 30, 1954, when a troop carrier plane crashed into the mess hall, killing seven and injuring 10. Regardless of the risk to himself, he ran into the flaming wreckage to help rescue trapped and injured survivors, where he remained until the fire was contained. Corporal McGee's courageous response was instrumental in saving lives of injured survivors. As a result of his heroic actions, he was presented with the Soldier's Medal for Heroism as a member of the 77th Special Forces Group Airborne. Orville was a longtime member of the Special Forces Association and worked for the Norfolk Southern Railroad for 41 years. He served as president for the National Association of Retired and Veteran Railway Employees, better known as NARVRA, of Unit 30 in Council Bluffs for 22 years. He also served as a trustee for the Hazel Dell Township for 18 years. Left to cherish many lasting memories are his wife, Judy, of 39 years, children, and many loving family and friends. Orville and Judy Carlson were united in marriage on October 6, 1983. They enjoyed working together on their family-owned farm, along with spending time with loved ones. They have two daughters, Diana and spouse Bill Cooper, Kite Cooper of Omaha, Nebraska, and Pamela's spouse Joe Robinson of Fredericksburg, Virginia, grandchildren Nicole and spouse Corey Parker, Matthew Bumgars, Laura and spouse Kurt Krellman, Andrew Bumgars, and fiance Danielle, all of Omaha, Nebraska, Ariane and spouse Josh Mosier, and Nathan Robinson of Fredericksburg, Virginia, Alyssa and spouse Stephen Hafner of Clearwater, Florida, Jake and spouse Kaylee Cooper of Des Moines, Iowa, loving family members Barbara Harris and Angela Mathias, as well as 10 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. this Saturday, July 30th at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home. Celebration of Life service will be at 3 p.m. also on Saturday, July 30th at the funeral home. Interment with military honors at Hazel Dell Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Crescent Fire Department or NARVRE, that's NARVRE, National Association of Retired and Veteran Railway Employees. The next obituary is for Patricia M. Pat Prine. Pat was 79 of Council Bluffs. She passed away July 25th at the home of her daughter in Bennington, Nebraska. Pat was born March 17th, 1943 in Shenandoah, Iowa to Howard and Phyllis H. Shandy Proctor. She worked at Pfizer as a production supervisor for 30 plus years. Pat was preceded in death by her father, Howard Proctor, mother, Phyllis Hope Brown, husband Wayne T. Prine in 1994, brothers Richard Proctor, Keith, spouse Glenda Proctor, and sister Sharon and spouse Ed Nelson. She is survived by her children, Jamie, spouse Dan White of Bennington, Nebraska, Jim and spouse Jeanette Brown, Jeff and spouse Michelle Brown, John and spouse Kim Brown, all of Council Bluffs, 16 grandchildren, 29 great-grandchildren, partner Scott Gutow of Council Bluffs, sister-in-law Martha Proctor of Phoenix, Arizona, nieces and nephews. Funeral service is tomorrow, Friday at 11 a.m., the Philadelphia Church, 2019 South 8th Street. A lunch will immediately follow in the church hall. Graveside service and burial will follow at 3 p.m. in Wesley Chapel, Henderson, Iowa. The family will receive friends on Friday, 1 hour prior to the service at the church. The family will direct memorial contributions. And we have Rita M. Hermson. Rita was 80 of Council Bluffs, passed away July 26th. Rita was born August 23rd, 1941 in Lake City, Iowa to the late Edward and Teresa Yonke Retigan. In addition to her parents, Rita was preceded in death by her daughter, Robin Hermson, in 2015, sisters Karen Wiederin and Kathy Gravitt. Rita is survived by her children, Scott and spouse Jill Hermson, Gina and spouse Dan Kane, Eric Radigan, and Penny and spouse Tom Gilsdorf. 5 grandchildren, Bobby and spouse Jenny Hermson, Danielle and spouse Robbie Main, Carrie and spouse Jordan Fry, Kelsey and spouse Eric Arias, Harper Gilsdorf, 7 great-grandchildren as follows, Max, Luke, Amelia, Liam, Haley, Hazel, and James. Sisters are Norma and spouse Craig McQuaid and Jean Weber. Nieces and nephews. The funeral service will be Saturday at 10 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Interment is St. Joseph Cemetery with a lunch to follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. That's at 1350 East Pierce Street. Visitation with the family 1 hour prior to the service on Saturday at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to the American Lung Association or Down's Syndrome Association. Next, we have Richard O. Dick Bennett. And Dick was 85, and he passed away on his birthday, July 25th. Dick was born in Sterling, Oklahoma on July 25th, 1937, and was united in marriage to Judy Ann Long on April 6th, 1958. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Air Force from 1956 to 59 and worked for Chicago Lumber Company for over 17 years. Dick is preceded in death by his parents, Eyal and Hazel Bennett, an infant son, Robert Paul, wife, Judy Ann, on July 4th, 2022. Survivors include his daughters, Teresa Gracer, sons, Terry and spouse, Gwen, Alvin and Kevin Bennett, honorary daughter, Rhonda Silva, and all Council Bluffs, all from Council Bluffs, 11 grandchildren, 19 great-grandchildren, and a brother, Gail Bennett. Visitation is Sunday from 2 to 4. Funeral service is Monday, 10 a.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Dick will be laid to rest with his wife, Judy, in Ridgewood Cemetery. Funeral service will be live-streamed at www.cutleroneill.com. And that's spelled CutleroneillL.com. Pico Fred Rocha. Pico was 75 of Omaha, passed away July 26th at his home, surrounded by his loving family. Pico was born January 24th, 1947, in Council Bluffs to the late Pedro and Dorothy Wright Rocha. He proudly served his country in the U.S. Army for 3 years. Pico married Annette Vargas on November 6, 1967, in Omaha. They were blessed with 3 children, Matt, Shannon, and Steve. Pico worked at ASARCO, ASARCO, and Griffin Pipe, retiring in 2013. In addition to his parents, Pico was preceded in death by 4 brothers and 1 sister. Pico is survived by his wife of 54 years, Annette Rocha, children, Matt and spouse Frankie Shannon. He is survived by his children, Matt and spouse Frankie, Shannon and spouse John Lindell, Steve and spouse Isola, all of Omaha. 9 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, sisters Marcella Jacobson, Patty and spouse Jim Davis, all of Council Bluffs, Tina and spouse Bill Jones of Omaha, nieces and nephews. Funeral service, Saturday, 1 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Military rites will follow, tendered by the Canesville Riders Honor Guard. Following the service, family and friends are invited to the Grass Wagon for lunch and fellowship. Visitation with the family will be from noon to 1 p.m. on Saturday at the funeral home. Memorials are suggested to St. Croix Hospice. Next, we have Lemoyne Elliott Van Houten. And Lemoyne passed away Sunday, July 24th, at the age of 102, at home, surrounded by family and loved ones. He was born on May 9th, 1920, Mother's Day, in Battle Creek, Iowa, to Malcolm David and Mary Van Houten. He attended a one-room country school and graduated from Battle Creek High School in 1938. He attended Morningside College in Sioux City, where he and his future wife, Clyda Elaine Coolidge, who he later married on December 8, 1943, and was drafted into the United States Army in 1940. He landed in Cherbourg, France, in August of 1944 with the 26th Infantry Division, which was part of General George S. Patton's 3rd Army. They fought their way across France and were garrisoned in Metz, France, when the Battle of the Bulge broke out in Belgium in December of 1944. They joined into the battle, and he was awarded the Bronze Star and 4 battle campaign stars for valor in the campaigns. Later, in 2014, he was awarded by the French government the French Legion of Honor, France's version of our Medal of Honor, in a ceremony in Ouistreham, France, where the medal was pinned on him by the retired French general. After the war, he settled in Council Bluffs and began a career at United Airlines that spanned 40 years. After retiring from United, he began a career at Cutler O'Neill Funeral Home and retired from there after 20 years at the age of 95. He was preceded in death by his parents and all 4 siblings, John, Kenny, Catherine, and Bud, and his wife Elaine, who passed away in 2002. He is survived by 3 sons, Randy and spouse Diane, David and spouse Jan, and Dan and spouse Diane, along with grandchildren Jeremy, Joplin, Joshua, Jessica, Angela, Travis, Jasmine, and Jacob, 12 great-grandchildren, and his beloved cat Oliver. The visitation is at Cutler O'Neill on Friday, July 29th from 5 to 8 p.m. And the funeral is Saturday, July 30th at 10 a.m. at Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Omaha. Interment, Cedar Lawn Cemetery with military rites by the American Legion Rainbow Post 2 at 1 p.m. Memorials are suggested to Trinity Episcopal Church and Midlands Humane Society. And there are 2 more. Greg Schoenig. Greg was 60 of Glenwood, Iowa, died July 26th at UNMC in Omaha. He is survived by children, Aaron, spouse Tracy Schoenig of Neola, Iowa, and Michelle, spouse Dylan Zanders of Malvern, Iowa. 2 grandchildren, special friend Chris Androy of Malvern, siblings Cindy and spouse Jeff Rinderer of Salina, Kansas, Nancy and spouse Jim Lippis of Glenwood, David and spouse Linda Schoenig of Silver City, Iowa, and LaDonna and spouse John Coover of Council Bluffs. Visitation, 5 to 7 p.m., Friday, July 29th, at Charles and Florence Lacken Community Center, Malvern. Funeral service, 10:30, Saturday, July 30th, at St. John Lutheran Church in Mineola, Iowa. Burial in Mineola Cemetery in lieu of flowers, memorials to Mills County 4-H Foundation. And lastly, Michelle R. Cole. Michelle, 60, of David City, formerly of Council Bluffs, passed away on July 13th at Dunklow Gardens in Fremont. Funeral service Saturday, July 30th at 10:30 Central Standard Time, Redeemer Lutheran Church. Private family burial at a later date. And our biggest sympathies go out to all of the families and loved ones and friends of the dearly departed. Moving on over to sports, ISU Hoops gets 5-star commitment from Billiou. Omaha Billiou, the 12th best prospect in the class of 2023, according to 247 Sports, announced Tuesday night his commitment to Iowa State's men's basketball program. Billiou, a 6'8", 210-pounder, is a consensus 5-star recruit. His commitment constitutes a major recruiting win for Cyclones head coach T.J. Utzelberger and his staff, which has also gained 2023 commitments from top 35 prospect Milan Momcilovic of Pewaukee, Wisconsin, and 4-star shooting guard Delani Hamilton of Austell, Georgia. Billiou chose ISU over other final options such as Kansas, Oregon, and immediately pursuing a professional career via the NBA G League. He grew up in Waukee, but transferred last season to Link Academy in Branson, Missouri. And the other article here is Iowa wide receiver Tyrone Tracy Jr. runs the ball during the Hawkeyes' win over Penn State earlier this season at Kinnick Stadium. There's a photo of him carrying the ball. Former teammates add juice to November Hawkeye game. Indianapolis. When Iowa visits Purdue in early November, Hawkeye defenders expect to be lining up across a familiar foe, or from a familiar foe, rather. Former Hawkeye receivers Tyrone Tracy Jr. and Charlie Jones are expected to fill important roles for the Boilermakers after transferring from Iowa, Tracy in December and Jones in May. Maybe behind closed doors, there might be a little extra juice, but I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that out loud. Iowa safety Kayvon Merriweather said with a laugh at the Big Ten kickoff on Tuesday. I love T, I love Charlie, and it will be fun to see them again on the field. Merriweather expects both to contribute to a Purdue team, is working to reload its passing attack after losing its top two receivers from a year ago. Purdue does a good job of putting people in positions to play to their strengths, and Charlie and Tyler are two good receivers. It should be an interesting game, Merriweather said. Iowa linebacker Jack Campbell said only he wished nothing the best for both Tracy and Jones, who is also expected to factor into. And that article continues, the Boilermakers return game plans after being named the Big Ten Return Specialist of the Year last season. Purdue coach Jeff Brohm was asked Wednesday about Jones's transfer to Purdue, which occurred in late May after Jones had participated in spring practices at Iowa. Brohm did not directly respond to the question, saying only that he helps the Boilermakers fill a need. There's always a few holes you might find a way to go to the transfer portal and help your team improve and get better, Brohm said. We did lose our top two receivers, so we've got to replace some of those. We were fortunate enough to get Charlie Jones on our football team, who's played a lot of really good football. I think he'll play a great role in our offense. Bridging the gap. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said the addition of John Budmeyer to the Hawkeye staff as an offensive analyst is helping offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz adjust to his new assignment as Iowa's quarterbacks coach. Former Wisconsin quarterback Budmeyer worked as graduate assistant at Pittsburgh in Wisconsin before becoming the Badgers' quarterback coach in 2018. He spent last season at Colorado State, where the entire staff was dismissed following the 2021 season. Having John join us is like a gift from heaven, Kirk Ferentz said. He is between assignments and he brings something to our program we need. Brian is long on offensive coach experience, but short on quarterback coaching experience. Brian has been able to tap into John's expertise as he takes on his new role. The Iowa coach said the move of Brian Ferentz to coach quarterback seems to be working as designed. The key component from my vantage point was to have our play caller be coaching our quarterbacks. Just trying to minimize the opportunity for confusion or that type of thing. Get a little more clarity in what we're doing, Ferentz said. So far, so good. Instant impact. Freshman Xavier Nwankpa isn't on the preseason two-deep roster, Iowa unveiled Tuesday, a byproduct in part of the depth the Hawkeyes have in the secondary. But it wouldn't surprise Ferentz if the five-star recruit from Southeast Polk finds his way onto the field this fall. It wouldn't shock me. For guys in their first semester, it really is like Algebra 3 or Calculus. My guess is all those guys, you'll see a huge jump from him in August now that he knows, Ferentz said, adding that after enrolling for the spring semester, Nwankpa was just trying to figure out where to go, what to do, and all those kinds of things. Iowa coaches have liked what they have seen from both true freshman defensive backs who enrolled early, Nwankpa and TJ Hall. Asked specifically about Nwankpa, Ferentz said, he's a top-notch guy. I know he was highly recruited, but you would never know that if you watched him day by day. He's just one of those guys, and he's not impressed with himself. Preseason picks. The Big Ten no longer assembles a preseason poll that establishes favorites in its division races. There is a media poll with representatives from throughout the states within the league's footprint, and Ohio State and Wisconsin were heavy favorites to win their respective divisions. The Buckeyes were listed first on all 36 ballots and finished in front of Michigan and Penn State in the East, while the Badgers received 31 first-place votes in the West. Iowa, picked second, received 3, and Minnesota was listed first on 2 ballots. Quick response. Ferenc had a 2-word response when asked why teams in the West Division of the Big Ten have had such a difficult time winning the conference championship. Ohio State, Ferenc said. No team from the West has won in the Big Ten title game since the league went to an East-West divisional setup in 2014. I have time for one short article here on The Nation and World. Ex-cops sentenced in Floyd's death. King Thao were convicted of violating victims' civil rights. A federal judge, and this is in St. Paul, a federal judge on Wednesday sentenced 2 former Minneapolis police officers who were convicted of violating George Floyd's civil rights to lighter terms than recommended in sentencing guidelines, calling one, quote, truly a rookie officer, end quote, and describing the other as, quote, a good police officer, father, and husband, end quote. U.S. District Judge Paul Magnuson sentenced J. Alexander King to 3 years in prison and To Tao to 3.5 years for violating Floyd's rights in the May 25th, 2020 killing in which then-officer Derek Chauvin pinned Floyd's neck with his knee for more than 9 minutes as the 46-year-old black man said he couldn't breathe and eventually grew still. King pinned Floyd's back, Thao held back concerned bystanders, and a fourth officer, Thomas Lane, held Floyd's feet. Lane was sentenced last week to 2 years, while Chauvin was sentenced earlier to 21 years. The lower sentences for King, who is black, and Tao, who is Hmong American, raise questions about whether they would consider a plea deal or risk a state court trial on October 24th when they face counts of aiding and abetting second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Lane, who is white, pleaded guilty to a state charge of aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter and is awaiting sentencing in that case. And just a couple little side notes here. Redlining. A Pennsylvania mortgage company owned by billionaire businessman Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway discriminated against potential black and Latino homebuyers in Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware, the Department of Justice said Wednesday, in what is being called the second largest redlining settlement in history. Monkeypox. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus on Wednesday advised men at risk of catching monkeypox to consider reducing their sexual partners, quote, for the moment, quote, following the UN Health Agency declaring the escalating outbreaks in multiple countries to be a global emergency. Biden. President Joe Biden ended his COVID-19 isolation on Wednesday, telling Americans they can, quote, live without fear, end quote, of the pandemic if they take advantage of booster shots and treatments, the protections he credited with his swift recovery. All right, folks. That's going to do it for today for the reading of the Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, July 28th. I've been your reader, Cynthia Pokorna Martinez. You may access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening and have a peaceful day.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.